This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Happy Friday, folks. Thanks for listening. And a look at politics begins this hour. Historic moments in Egypt this weekend, hopefully not historic shenanigans over the fiscal cliff and the debt ceiling looming in Washington, D.C. Here you go, just to get you in the spirit.
Ands and buts are like candy and nuts. If that were the case, every day would be Christmas.
Speaker of the House John Boehner's festive use of language there. Give us some of your favorite Boehnerisms from the always well-tanned Mr. Speaker at 877-8-MY-TAKE or over at thetakeaway.org. We begin in Egypt, though. Tomorrow, Egyptians will go to the polls once again to vote on a referendum for a new constitution, a constitution backed by conservative Islamists who hold power in Cairo. Political unrest has been escalating there since President Mohamed Morsi granted himself new governmental powers on November 22nd and declared himself and his government beyond judicial review. Morsi has since relented, but protests continue, and all of this will have an impact on the voting for Egypt's new constitution. Joining us now is journalist Isander El Amrani. Isander is the founder and publisher of The Arabist, a blog devoted to Middle East political analysis. Isander El Amrani, welcome to the program.
Hi, glad to be here.
Insofar as the coverage I've seen of what's going on in Egypt, there does appear to be a high degree of awareness of both this vote that's taking place and the constitution itself, what's in this constitutional document. Is that your impression?
Absolutely. People have been really mobilized by what's happened over the last 2 weeks. I mean, it's the deepest crisis Egypt has been in since the 18 days that led in the fall of Hosni Mubarak. So people are taking a great interest, not just the people who always came out in the streets, went to Tahrir Square and elsewhere. But, you know, you're seeing protests across the country. It's ordinary people. It's not, you know, the professional activist class only. This is the moment, the foundational moment of what Egypt is going to be like, at least for the next few years. You know, the document that defines the balance of how much religion there is, what the balance of power is between the different branches of government. I think most Egyptians realize that this is important. You know, even in a poor country where there's a lot of illiterate people, there's really a fantastic level of engagement.
Is this seen as Morsi's document, Morsi's constitution, or is it seen as something that comes from the military? Is there a constituency attached to this particular document that's being voted on?
Clearly, it's a constitution that was driven through, rushed through the Constituent Assembly by Islamists. So it's seen as an Islamist constitution, whether it's Morsi's or the Muslim Brotherhood or the wider Islamist currents. But that's very much the way it's being branded, certainly by the opposition. That's the way the Islamists themselves have tried to brand it. They're saying, you know, this is the constitution where we get Sharia in, Islamic law in. People who oppose it are bad Muslims or the Christians. Unfortunately, this whole debate has taken on quite a sectarian tone.
And so if you're a Christian in Cairo, you're very fearful of this document, this kind of rhetoric. And in a sense, the Muslim Brotherhood has set up a discourse which is likely to be more divisive going forward rather than less.
The Christians, I think, it's not that their rights are not protected by this constitution. There are some protections there. But what it signals, I mean, first, the fact, and perhaps the most shocking thing, is that there was not a single Christian in the Constituent Assembly when this draft constitution was approved. They had boycotted a week earlier. And that's even more shocking than not a single liberal there. Because there's a tradition in Egypt, even under dictatorship, that you always have to be inclusive with the, you know, this is 10 to 15% of the country. You don't want to become like some other Middle Eastern countries where the, you know, the sectarian divide is super politicized. Egypt for the last 100 years has largely avoided that. And it's a break with that tradition. But in a sense, Muslims who are not ultra-conservative or Islamist or believe that Islam should have this overt political role have as much to be worried about when you have an article against blasphemy.
Let's talk about Mohamed Morsi for a moment. How has he handled his international role in the settling of the Gaza dispute for now versus his, it seems, mishandling of this whole rule by decree attempt to take power and then revoking it just a week or so later?
It's an interesting comparison because if you look at November 20th, when the Gaza ceasefire was secured, Mohamed Morsi was given a lot of the credit for that. By the international community, you saw a reconciliation to some extent between President Obama and President Morsi after the fallout that followed the embassy riots in September. In Egypt, people thought he handled the thing fairly well. and then does something that's a complete overreach. And I think he underestimated the level of resistance that there would be. I think they were really taken aback. And part of his reaction since then has been one of panic. You know, the decision to rush through the Constitution, even though it's a November 22nd decree, he'd extended the time for debate by 2 months. And then 3-4 days later, he cuts it back and says, no, we're going to rush for it now. I think it tells of panic, and it's a little bit worrying if that's going to be his leadership style.
In the relative silence on the decree, did the U.S. miss an opportunity here?
I think so. I think that, you know, the U.S. is very reluctant to get dragged into a crisis, especially over a constitution, which is a very sovereign thing. In Egypt, it feels that it's not appreciated really by any side in Egypt. The opposition now sees the Muslim Brotherhood as having allied itself with the U.S. and basically the deal being as long as they don't do anything rash on Israel, they have carte blanche on anything else. I think that the U.S. has underestimated its leverage. I mean, because there's certain things they consider sacred, such as the $1.3 billion of military aid to Egypt, such as the general macroeconomic stability of Egypt, where, you know, it doesn't want to threaten aid cuts and things like that. There's other things they can do. What we haven't seen is very forceful, high-level diplomacy. When the State Department says, oh, we wish Egypt has a more inclusive constitution and leaves it at that, well, you know, how is that going to happen? There's a date set for the referendum. The constitution's been voted on. What exactly are you doing to do that? From this administration, you sense that there, you know, there's fatigue, Middle East fatigue.
Well, let me put you on the spot here before we go. It's under El Amrani. Do you think Mohamed Morsi, a year from today, will still be firmly in power in Egypt?
I think this crisis has really eroded the narrow confidence. Remember, this is a president elected with 52% of the vote that existed in him. The tentative trust, especially by non-Islamists, the people who voted for him, that the people have put in him. The Muslim Brotherhood will come out weakened in this, and we might see that in electoral results, maybe not in this referendum, but down the line in a few months in parliamentary elections. And it's hard to predict, you know. I mean, will it still be there? Yes, I think so. Has this really hurt his ability to be perceived as a president of all Egyptians who can drive through difficult reforms, especially on the economy? I think that's hurt him.
Isander El Amrani, founder and publisher of The Arabist, a blog devoted to Middle East political analysis. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.